Welcome to the Experience Points Podcast, PAX Edition 2009, Day 3.
Welcome back to the Experience Points Podcast. I'm Scott Juster.
I'm George Albor.
We are the co-creators of experiencepoints.blogspot.com, a website we created and dedicated to the serious but not humorless analysis of video games and culture. And this is a final night of PAX.
Final night, a little teary-eyed.
A little misty, a little infected with some kind of nerd virus I picked up here.
It's deadly.
I'm changing! But we are trudging through, so this was the final day of PAX. The afterglow has started to fade over the Emerald City.
Aww.
And we turn to the microphone to immortalize it.
Definitely. So the first panel, and again, as you've noticed if you listen to the other ones, we've been just mostly talking about the panels that PAX has put on. And the first panel we went to today was an interesting panel. It was actually called The Future of Games.
Mm.
And it was talking about what would happen in the next 5 years, the next 10 years, and trends that we see developing that are going to be sticking around with us.
Mm.
And this panel was presented by only one person, so it's really more of a pan. It's not a panel.
it was more of a lecture, but in a good way.
His name was Andrew Mayer, and he designed Pets,
yeah,
which was the offshoot of all those stupid games that end with a Z. So,
yeah.
I mean, he's aware of the monster he's created.
Yeah, he's very cognizant of his role, and he's not self-deprecating. I mean, kind of self-deprecating, but kind of he's very good-humored and realistic about what his role is like in the video game industry.
Yeah.
He doesn't try to like play up Pets like, you know, it set the world on fire or something, even though it kind of did.
It did. He also worked for a time at Cartoon Network as a creative director, doing casual games for Play First, and right now he is a social games consultant.
Yeah.
And a lot of his experience for the time being is working on Facebook games, actually.
Mm.
And I thought it was kind of interesting. He covered so many things. He covered piracy and DRM. He covered the difference between the PC markets and the console markets,
mm-hmm,
and the indie markets. It was actually one of my favorite panels.
Yeah, he did a really good job kind of delineating what the difference is between casual versus social versus, you know, how we consider things to be hardcore, not hardcore. He made some good points about the PC kind of being the, you know, whichever year you pick in gaming history, the PC is always the platform where much of the innovation happens.
Yeah, and it's funny because it goes kind of against our podcast recently about online games on the PC front.
Yeah.
Because he does talk a little bit about, you know, things are getting better. Software is getting better. You don't necessarily need to have a PC that's so tech-driven.
Mm-hmm.
Scaling issues do pretty well. So even if you don't have the top-of-the-line PC, you can still operate a lot of the games that people play online.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of talked about how some of those more core titles anyway are becoming a niche subject regardless, because there's so many casual games and there's so many games that are coming out for an audience that is not the traditional gamer, that it's becoming kind of a niche thing. And that's not bad. It doesn't mean that the things that are traditional, the games that we know and love, are going away, which I actually thought was kind of cool. Someone who was actually hopeful, but still included a lot of the casual games that are
It resonated with a very practical realism. I mean, he coined the number one term in our opinion of PAX, the farmpocalypse, in which he showed at least like 5 or 6 different farming games on Facebook, some of which have bigger install bases than WoW.
Yeah.
And he's currently working with people making more farming games.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is they're all making tons of money.
Yeah.
And again, it's something
doing so by interesting ways, like getting people to sign up for Netflix for in-game rewards, or getting people to kind of buy into advertising.
Yeah.
You know, not in a necessarily an active way, but by allowing them to by allowing themselves to be targeted.
Which I thought was particularly interesting, because I was always under the impression that subscriptions and basic ads were the best way to go about monetizing a system like that.
Yeah.
But he was actually mentioning, you know, one of the best ways is just get a lot of people to to play it for free and then offer incentives. Subscriptions and incentives.
Really, WoW is the outlier here. I mean, like, by doing a subscription, you know, it's really novel in comparison to these other games that are successful.
Yeah, and I don't think that when he says Farmpocalypse, he actually thinks it's all going to be farm games.
Yeah.
But, you know, that idea that the casual market is growing and people like him, to some extent, don't really care who's playing their games as long as people are playing them.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned, you know, demographics to him don't matter so much when really what matters is metrics. It's not who's playing, but how you're playing.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really interesting. And I think that I think that makes a lot of sense. I think the future of games, even in big publishers, are going to be people trying to pay attention to their audience and incorporate them into the product in a new way.
And it really, I don't want to say undercuts, it sounds aggressive, but it really takes a different tact that a lot of the other panels didn't take. Most of the other panels that we talked to, you know, girls in gaming and you know, legal issues, lawyers in gaming, so forth, it's about who is playing it. And his whole thing is it's not about who's playing it. The developers don't care who's playing it. They want to know how they're playing it because that's what targeting is. You know, it doesn't matter who's playing it as long as the clicks are there.
Exactly. Yeah. And one last thing about his thing, about his panel as well. It was cool to see him kind of approach, I guess I kind of said it already, but the way that he approached the casual market becoming more complex, because I think he does give credit to some of those social games. You know, there's an interesting system within that Farmpocalypse, the inevitable Farmpocalypse, and the four horsemen of the Farmpocalypse are fairly complex, but that doesn't mean it's going to be the type of complex we think of when we think of core games.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
I also thought it was cool that he mentioned used titles during the Q&A.
Yeah, he had some... I mean, he basically said, like, the next 5 years is crucial for GameStop because the time is coming very rapidly that digital distribution is going to take hold, publishers are going to want to get into the distribution market, and GameStop would do well to make itself a content portal rather than, in his words, a pawn shop, which is pretty much exactly what it is.
And that's not new. I think a lot of people know that. I think GameStop knows it. So
yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they do with it. I'm definitely looking forward to that. Okay, so next panel?
Yeah. The next panel we had was Games, Culture, and Society. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty interested in this panel. Mm-hmm. It was moderated by Aaron Ruby, who runs GameCulture.com. Mm-hmm. James Portnow, who works for Divide by Zero Games.
We've seen that guy like 10 times PAX. Yeah, he's everywhere. He's the hardest working man at PAX.
Good man. there was Jennifer Mercurio, who worked for the Entertainment Consumers Association. And there was Joel DeYoung, who was a director of technology for Hothead Games.
Yeah.
And they kind of went, they took a pretty broad route when addressing culture.
Yeah.
I think that when people attend something like PAX, we tend to reaffirm our preconceived notions about what gamer cultures are by repeating some of the same things that have been said for a while now.
And
not to say that that's bad, but, you know, it's just not something that, it's something that I've heard before.
To be very specific, we at PAX, and I include myself in this too, we get a lot of mileage out of using this straw man of the person who calls gamers, oh, antisocial, fat, ugly, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I mean, and we don't really cite where we're getting those, we don't really cite where we're getting that character from. And so it's interesting in a broad sense to talk about that. I'm not quite sure we got to that point in this panel. I mean, and we didn't touch on the question of, so if there is a gamer culture, or maybe gamer culture is an outmoded term since there's so many gamers, would you then be comfortable saying that the people at PAX are like the zeitgeist of this culture, like the cultural arbiters, like saying what is gaming and what isn't? Because that's kind of what PAX is implying in a way.
And I think that's the case. I think that people who are, you know, the gaming elite do, I believe, disproportionately affect how gamers create a gamer culture.
Yeah.
Even for my mother, for example, who plays Farmville, you know, the decisions of people here at PAX and the way that they relate to games does, in fact, affect her.
Mm-hmm.
It also affects society at large, and the panel addressed that a little
bit. But then is the question, like, does the fact that your mom plays Farmville have more of an impact than all the hot air that comes out of us? You know, I mean, like, is her action...
I like to think that.
Yeah. it's a troubling... It's kind of a troubling topic, and one that I'm not sure where I fall on it, because it's weird to kind of call yourself a cultural elite, especially when... Let's be generous and say that there were 70,000 people at PAX. you know, even if a title sells 500,000, like 500,000 minus 60,000, like even if every single person at PAX bought that thing, there's still hundreds of thousands, yeah, if not millions of people that decide where game culture goes.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah. Although I think I put a little bit more faith in the type of word of mouth, mm-hmm, and the way that journalism plays a role in that, because it does, you know.
Which is a good lead-in to the next panel with Engai. Sure. He's one of, I would say, you know, the elites of the elite, if we're going to consider ourselves that.
Absolutely. You know? Before we go, though, yeah, I have one gripe that I wrote down that I wanted to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
I heard countless times during the conference the statement that video games make more money than movies, yeah, therefore we win, or yeah, we need to figure something out, or game culture needs to change.
Yeah.
I agree that we are important entertainment, yeah, media. Movies make way more money than video games.
Worldwide.
Yeah. When people use the statistic, what they're usually referring to are box office dollars,
yeah,
which is the few weeks that they're open in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
There is a huge amount of money that is made off of DVD sales.
Yep.
There's a huge amount of money made off theater sales abroad and DVD sales abroad.
Yeah.
We're talking merchandise. Yeah. We're talking long-term royalties when it appears on television shows, something that video games don't have.
And not only that, you know, even if movies are outrageously expensive, but at $10, they're, you know, a $60 game, a movie pales in comparison in price. And so for every one person that buys a $60 game, you could have six people with the same dollars seeing that movie.
Exactly.
So culturally,
it is more, yeah, ubiquitous.
Exactly.
And then the other thing is you've got outliers of a few people who spend way more money on even games that are casual and most people who consider themselves gamers wouldn't necessarily call games.
Yeah.
You know, things like Farmville or things like the tons of money that Andrew Mayer was talking about of people spending on virtual goods,
yeah,
you know, that,
yeah,
kind of thing. Anyway, that's just a gripe of mine. So
yeah,
let's continue.
It happened a lot. So the next one was an article. I mean, sorry, an article. It was a panel.
Well, it's funny because so many of the panelists were journalists,
exactly,
that we read.
So. We're so used to reading them and kind of seeing them on the Twitter sphere and so forth. But the next one was, what was it called? It was called Sex.
I think it was called Murder, Sex, and Drugs.
Yeah.
And this panel was hosted by Corvus Elrod, mm-hmm, of Man Bites Blog, who, mm-hmm, we got to meet and talk to. Great guy,
yep,
great panel, great moderator. And people who were on the panel included Deirdre Kai.
Mm-hmm.
Deirdre Kiai, mm-hmm, of Hothead Games, as well as all of her other, mm-hmm, online entities. Nels Anderson, also of Hothead,
mm-hmm,
who does the Above 49 blog. And
close personal friend of the Experience Points podcast.
Well, he was kind enough to appear in our podcast, and it was great to actually meet him. There was Engai Kroll, of, uh-huh, course, the, mm-hmm, the journalist and consultant
at yeah,
large.
Mm-hmm.
There was a fellow by the name of Damon Brown,
yeah,
who was...
I had no idea who he was until this panel. He's a really interesting guy.
He's a journalist. He writes for ARP. He writes for Playboy.
He writes for The New Yorker. He writes for all these seemingly antithetical publications about games.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And he also recently published a book called, yeah, Porn and Pong.
Yeah.
That looks really interesting, and he was a really articulate and... frankly, I wish I could have talked to him more. He,
yeah,
was a really cool guy.
Yeah.
And lastly, there was Max, I believe his last name is Batcher,
mm-hmm,
and I,
yeah,
got a chance to talk to him.
Yeah, we met him last,
yeah,
night.
Yeah, he was really cool. I'd never heard of him before, mm-hmm, and I'm glad I had the opportunity. Anyway, after all of those praise for the
yeah,
panelists and whatnot, the panel was really interesting,
yeah,
and I'm really glad we went to this one, and it was kind of discussing in a way that the sex in games didn't approach,
yeah,
the way that we not only... how we depict and view sexuality, but how we want sex and murder and drugs depicted,
mm-hmm,
and how it's something we can even appreciate.
Yeah.
You know, that there are games where someone who is murderous, sexual, deviant,
mm-hmm,
And violent could theoretically produce a good game. And
yeah,
I think a lot of the panelists had really interesting points on that.
Yeah. And, you know, Nels was saying that there's two problems here with this. Like, one, to make a game that, you know, means something, that has a resonance, the developers need to make sure that these games are also engaging. What gets thrown around a lot in this conversation is Far Cry 2. People had major gripes about the mechanics and dynamics of Far Cry 2, which ended up marring their experience of what was philosophically a very interesting experiment.
Yeah.
And so it's a good point to make that you... still must make sure that the game is engaging when the players are playing it.
Right.
Being very careful to avoid the F word, which is fun, which was my pet peeve of PAX. People use fun all too often to describe video games, because if you're trying to make a serious game, it might not be fun like, yeah, I'm eating Pop Rocks on a roller coaster yeah, type fun. It will be fun in what Nels described, like the way that Schindler's List is rewarding yeah, to watch. And then on the other side, the player must be prepared to purchase a game like this, because that's what makes a difference.
And seek it out and join in on the discussion.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's, again, it's a lot to ask of the players, but if we're talking about the elite and the way that we affect culture, it can have a dramatic impact.
Exactly.
I also like that Nels mentioned the engagement aspect of it, and Max followed up later when we were discussing sex mm-hmm, about how difficult it is to depict sex
yeah,
in video games
yeah,
because if you're going to make it in a gameplay sense, mm-hmm, if you're going to have the God of War style quick time event yeah, involved in the sexual act,
yeah,
it gets a little fuzzy because it's so obvious you're not actually engaging in a sexual act. You're
yeah,
engaging in this kind of game, and there's this fear that you'll trivialize it. You know, Engai mentioned that one of the problems with games that are offensive is just that game makers are not necessarily proceeding. The phrase he used was that game makers should proceed boldly and thoughtfully.
Yeah.
So they shouldn't be scared or shy of mm-hmm, depicting serious themes like yeah, murder, sex, and drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But they need to think about it in a thoughtful manner.
And of course, he made the point of Resident Evil 5 with its tie-in to cultural and historical imagery of racism. And the thing that a thing that freaked me out as well, seeing Kurt Cobain in
Rock Band.
Is it Rock Band or Guitar Hero? I want to say it's Guitar Hero because actually, they're more soulless.
Yeah.
But, you know, seeing a hacked Kurt Cobain do, like, you know, a Johnny Cash song or do, like, a Flava Flav song or something was, like, you know, kind of unsettling.
Yeah.
The one thing that I kind of, you know, to toot my own horn here is I think that sometimes when developers make games that they don't think are making serious statements, it's just that they might not see it. Like, I spent weeks talking about Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare in a way that I'm not sure the developers intended me to talk about it.
Yeah, I agree with you, actually. I don't think the majority of the developers yeah, see that necessarily.
And so I think that we can't write off games that aren't, that don't have an avowed serious purpose. I think we can subvert that and make it serious.
Yeah.
You know, like, if we really want to look and dig, you know, we can kind of throw a monkey wrench in it by kind of looking at these games and what they actually say and what they don't say, because that makes it, you know, that makes it more relevant.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
What else do we want to talk about in this panel? I mean, there's a lot of stuff that they talked about.
There was a lot of stuff. I guess what I would see as one of the main themes was just the difficulty of approaching serious topics in games, because not only do you have to make it engaging, but you have to make it engaging using game mechanics without being distasteful.
You know,
you have to use tact.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard. You know, even Far Cry 2 doesn't always achieve what it's trying to achieve, because it has to pull off an almost, you know, carnival-esque trick.
Yeah.
Of it's got to be a huge feat to be able to pull off something that's serious.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, part of the reason I liked the panel so much is that all of the panelists were, if not optimistic, they were eager to try.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something that I think is really, really exciting to see.
Yeah, definitely.
One more thing that I thought was
mm-hmm,
cool
mm-hmm,
is Engai mentioned
the
scene
yes,
in BioShock
mm-hmm,
where Andrew Ryan is asking, oh, okay, real quick, spoilers for BioShock.
Yeah.
Andrew Ryan is telling you to essentially kill him.
Yeah.
And it was just so cool because he mentioned that maybe one of the ways they could have made it more,
because this situation is all about agency, and Andrew Ryan is trying to show you that you know, a man chooses, a slave obeys. And the whole, this is the pivotal scene in BioShock when it is about making a choice.
Right.
And the game doesn't really give the player an active choice to make, which is an artistic statement. But Engai had this idea. Exactly.
Because essentially, regardless, you can still jump around. You could try to avoid the inevitable.
Yeah.
You could act like a total buffoon before mm-hmm, you actually off Andrew Ryan.
Yeah.
Engai's idea was to essentially make every button that you could possibly push
yeah,
going towards Andrew Ryan and eventually killing him.
And yeah, it was brilliant.
It may sound small, but me and Scott both turned to each other at the exact same yeah, time and were like, that's a great
yeah,
idea. Yeah, and I also really like that Engai in general, when he was talking about how messages are transmitted, when he was talking about you know, how to depict sex, how to depict violence, mentioned that there's no hard and fast rule, and
yeah,
that even some of the things that we think are cliche and overdone today aren't necessarily bad if they were in an environment where they weren't overdone.
Exactly.
And I think that's something that's important to know, that, you know, no matter what we think as a poor choice in certain games, it's not always the case. Our design tools are plenty.
So. Yeah, definitely. Excellent panel all around. Okay, what next? Is this the floor now?
Yeah, we're done. Yeah, so essentially those were all of the panels we tried to get. There were maybe a couple we missed.
Yeah.
We did get some time at the expo hall, so there were a lot of games. Of course, there's tons of media already out there. If you want to look and hear about some of the things that were on the show floor, you could visit all of the sites that I'm sure you already know about. So just real quick, we'll cover some of the ones that we like in particular.
Definitely. Let's see. One of them that I thought was really intriguing, and I had seen this game at GDC, it was called Paint Something.
It was called Tag.
Tag, yeah.
The Art of Painting or something.
And
that was one of the PAX 10.
It was one of the PAX 10, and it's a first-person... I mean, I guess it's a first-person shooter. You're literally shooting paint out of a gun, but the paint gives you certain abilities when you walk over it. So let's say you paint a red strip of paint on the ground, it will boost you. Or if you paint a green strip of paint, it will make you jump, so you can boost them to a jump. I thought that was a very clever, very understated way of doing a game that is, first, doing something really hard, first-person platforming, and second, there was nary a space marine nor an alien to shoot in that game, so it was kind of it was cool.
It reminded me of Portal in the way that you are forced to reimagine the environment and how you approach it, because a wall is not necessarily a wall. Another one of the PAX 10 that we played was this game called Carnival, and it was from a Singapore developer, and it was actually kind of a cool, simple game. I actually really
Imagine Pixel Junk Eden, but more kinetic. Like, there's more of a weight behind your jumps.
It essentially used ragdoll physics to grab a ragdoll and toss it about a level, and it was almost like a puzzle platformer.
What it is it's trying to simulate kind of a trapeze type dynamic. It was cool, and the guy was very nice. And he, you know, we talked to him a little bit about how he was developing the game. And I just eat that kind of stuff up because it's platforming and it's vertical platforming. I love that stuff.
And you could tell the guy was really into what he had created, so that was cool.
Yeah.
Also, there, similar to Tag in the sense of reimagining an environmental space, was Closure. And this was a game that was playable, a sort of test version online, where you have the light orb, and the parts of the level that are illuminated when in darkness exist, but when they're dark, they do not exist. So you change the level based upon where you move the light. And it was cool to see that actually in play, particularly a longer level. There was also Osmos there. There was Field Runners, which we didn't end up getting to see.
The next game from the... I'm blanking out the hack and slash game.
Behemoth Team.
Yeah, the next Behemoth game.
Although that wasn't Castle Crashers. Yeah.
Let's see, was there anything else in that kind of independent or...
There was a game called Shank that looked pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. It's basically a 2D brawler in the vein of the old Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. It doesn't have a publisher, and it's beautiful. I hope it gets a publisher
Absolutely.
Soon.
Absolutely. And it feels a lot like Venture Brothers. It's got such a cool aesthetic.
Yeah.
It's got a cartoon. It looks very funny.
Yeah.
It's strange sometimes to look at those indie games and see that they don't have a publisher yet, and just to know that
I think that one's going to get snapped up. I mean, I think that game will be...
Week.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I really like that game a lot. Let's see. So should we talk about the big boys?
The big boys, yeah. So that was other games that had a presence there that were clearly attractive to a lot of people. Mass Effect 2. Cool. Which
you were on blackout.
I was on blackout. Yeah. I closed my eyes when I was walking past Mass Effect 2 because I want to approach that game completely fresh, which is, personally, it's strange for me. It's not something that I normally do, but I've decided for whatever reason to do it this time. BioShock 2.
Yeah,
we saw some footage from that.
Gameplay footage and kind of a little teaser of it.
Scribblenauts,
which had one of the biggest lines in the entire show to get
for
to.
A DS game has off to them.
That game's going to be big.
Dante's Inferno.
What I like to call the Citizen Kane of video games.
You go to hell, Scott, and enjoy it. Left 4 Dead 2, which... I'm excited over, of course.
We didn't stand in line to play that one because it's basically a foregone conclusion that we'll be playing too much of that
Which,
game.
To be honest, this is pretty much the case with all of the big hits.
Exactly.
BioShock, first day. Heavy Rain, first day. God of War 3,
I watched and drooled over God of War 3 a little bit. Oh, man, I can't wait till that game comes out.
I guess there wasn't really too many surprises with
this. We saw Splinter Cell.
That one, I'd seen some footage online, seeing it in person with someone playing it. And by the way, the guy who was narrating it was hilarious.
He was kind of like a carnival huckster.
That game looks really impressive. I'm really looking forward to it now.
Yeah. Let's see, what else was there? I mean, there was a lot of...
There was a mechanical bull, which I thought was cool.
No, it was like a demon horse.
Yeah.
I have, you know, it's kind of a testament to, like, overshadowing your game, because I have no idea what game that was for. All I know is that it was throwing people off left and right. There was, there's a big one that I know...
Dragon Age Origins was there.
Dragon Age. Avatar.
Avatar the game.
Avatar, man. James Cameron's Avatar, not The Last Airbender. God, that's going to be confusing in a few months.
Yeah.
I didn't really like the look of this game that much, but I do think it's important to kind of note how tied into the movie it is, because it ties into one of the things that was kind of hit upon in a couple panels by a few of the speakers, in that Hollywood still views games as a marketing extension, and this game kind of felt like that.
I agree.
It kind of looked like a very colorful Gears of War. It kind of played like a very colorful Gears of War, and it seems like that game is very much playing it safe.
Yeah.
And it's meant to kind of expand the lore of Avatar rather than be an entity unto itself.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I think that was particularly obvious with all of the kind of, they had toys around.
Yeah.
Essentially, they accompanied it with other marketing tools.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But, you know, maybe a lot of games did that at the...
A lot of games do that, but I think it's one of the most blatant ones where the film is so big and such a huge thing. James Cameron's really pushing this really hard, and it just feels like it is yet another tool that is being used to push Avatar on us.
I agree.
Yeah.
Let's see. One more game that we tried was the new Super Mario Brothers Wii.
Oh, yeah.
Which we played.
Which was great, because I had just started playing the Nintendo DS new Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, it was great. I had a good time.
Four-player Mario. It's not even co-op.
There's a level of competition.
Because you can grab items before the other person gets them and bounce on people's heads.
But you have to be ballsy, because there were a lot of scenes where we helped each other out.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's going to be... It's going to be a fun game. I'm looking forward to that a lot.
I think that's pretty much it for some of those ones on the show floor. There was Brink. There was a few other big titles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but...
But we saw a lot. We were able to get hands-on with a few of them. It's always kind of interesting seeing them in person rather than, like, YouTube videos and stuff.
So what did you think of Activision not being there?
I mean, Activision makes and eats its own lunch. You know what I'm saying? Like, they don't...
They're too big.
Yeah, I mean, like, it didn't...
But look, Blizzard does the same thing as a part of Activision.
Yeah.
Not only do they have their own convention, they still had an appearance here.
I think Blizzard is a unique case because they're so community-focused.
I guess, but that's kind of what took me back by not having Activision there, mm-hmm. is there were huge banners in this exhibition hall of, you know where the Sony booth is, you know where the EA booth is, the Rockstar booth, the Nintendo booth. To have Activision not have a presence there seemed like kind of a major, maybe not an insult, but you know,
it's confidence for them. I mean, like, they know that they have the game that everyone is going to want to buy, Modern Warfare 2.
But are they going to have the community presence? You know, like, and a lot of the panels we were going to today talked about the way that social gaming and building a community and building a culture, not only around gaming at large, but individual games is important, and that the future of games is this new field of involvement with the people who are making your games and publishing your games.
This is why I'm very afraid of us considering ourselves zeitgeist, because Modern Warfare is that way because millions and millions of people that aren't us are playing it online right now.
That's true.
I mean, that community is already there. It's still one of the most played games online. It came out years ago.
Sure, but I mean, Modern Warfare is not the only franchise that Activision is supporting.
That's true, but it's the one that matters right now.
I guess, I mean, we played a Nerf game. You know, like, it's not so much that I'm missing a particular Activision title. Uh-huh. It's just that for a major publisher not to have a presence at something that is so defined by gamer culture and players running a community together, it just seemed kind of
if we are as powerful as we are culturally, then it may be hubris, you know, like this, it may eventually their kind of their tact that they can just kind of blaze forward with whatever they want to do and not participate in these kinds of events might end up biting them.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'll have to see how things pan out. Well, because
it'll be a while after Modern Warfare 2, I'll tell you that much.
Exactly. So that's it for the floor.
That's it for
the floor. Final thoughts on PAX? The Omegathon?
Real quick, the last Omeganaut battle was Skee-Ball.
Yeah.
From like
old school, you know, you
Chuck E. Cheese.
Yeah, Skee-Ball. Things that you'd have to get quarters from your mom to play. Like, and it was pretty, clearly, it was the most epic game of Skee-Ball I'd ever seen.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. PAX in general, again, I've gone 4 years. I'm planning on going again already. Mm-hmm. There's this, again, and we talked about it yesterday when we were talking about it, the Omeganaut challenges, mm-hmm. and how there's a sense of community and a sense of pride and honor and glory,
yeah.
and all of these emotions that I think we don't really get all the time, even when we're interacting with each other online, because yeah. sometimes we can be pretty terse.
Yeah. And also, there's a simple mathematical fact that there aren't 6,000 people watching you do it.
Yeah.
Something that makes you feel like a gladiator is just something you cannot capture when you're by yourself.
I think there's something that's really cool and unique about PAX. And even if they don't bring a lot of people, I think that there's waves from it. You know, there's repercussions from it that in some way, shape, and form, maybe not validates, but makes gamers feel proud to be gamers in a way that E3 doesn't do, in a way that even GDC doesn't do.
Yeah.
You know, and
because it's very much about the players.
It's very much about the players. I'm just so glad it exists. You know.
Yeah, it's great. This was my first PAX, and really, it's just so amazing to be walking through the throngs that are in PAX, and you can kind of take a look at them, and it's like, all right, I could just kind of strike up a conversation with any person in this room, and they would have an automatic understanding of where I'm coming from on
Absolutely.
This stuff.
And there's so much to do. I didn't get to do any of the console free play. I missed a lot of the tabletop things.
I'm sure people just go to PAX and like meet up with people that they've met from other PAX.
Yeah.
And just play cards the whole time.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's just crazy. And there's so much stuff
to
do.
We were even lucky enough to meet some other bloggers, Travis McGill,
Joe Tortuga,
Deirdre, Joe Tortuga, Nels Anderson, Corvus.
Yeah.
There's just
many others.
So it's so cool to meet not only other bloggers, but other gamers in general. There's so many conversations we sparked up with people next to us,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, even drawing penises in Picto chat. Like, there's just something about that. So.
Yeah, it was great. I was definitely glad to be here, and I think it kind of, you know, finally being on the inside of it, I thought I kind of understood what PAX was all about and everything, but then, you know, it really, there's something to be said for like the crowd mentality of it in a positive way. Like, yeah. I have never been as excited about Halo as I have been when I was watching that Megathon.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a really cool scene.
So doesn't it just make you excited to keep the blog going and write something for Friday?
I know. Thanks, you know, to end it, thanks for those of you that are kind of sticking with us. And not only over the past 3 days with PAX and everything, because, you know, I mean, if you can stand listening to us 3 days in a row, I mean, there's something wrong. I don't know what's happening.
You're a true legend.
But, you know, in general, thanks a lot for reading the blog, for commenting on the site.
It's been about over a year now, I think, our birthdays.
Pretty soon. It's coming up, definitely. And it's been a really fun experience, and it's given me personally an insight and a deeper understanding about games that I thought I had before I started writing, and then I realized, oh, I really didn't know all that much, even because I wasn't participating in it.
It's exciting. It's fun.
It is. It's great. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. Well, signing off from Seattle.
Oh, we'll be back on Wednesday. We have normal stuff.
If you can't bear going, you know, 72 hours without hearing us, well, you are in luck, my friends, because we'll be back on Wednesday with another podcast.
All right. Until then.
All right. Have fun.
Have fun. Bye. Go to, because I